KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum, a series of talks and interviews with writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. I'm John O'Brien. Tonight we're featuring a scary summer reading edition. Our guest, the novelist Gillian Flynn, may encourage you to read her best-selling novel, Gone Girl, before the star-studded movie comes out in October. You'll hear her read the duly infamous Cool Girl passage and learn the gritty details of her unusual writing space and technique. And as an added bonus, you'll get Seattle writer Maria Semple's take on the Flynn phenomenon. Gone Girl lays out the fragments of a marriage gone terribly wrong. For some, it prompts the question, can you ever truly know those you love? Flynn's first book was Sharp Objects, followed by Dark Places. Gillian Flynn spoke at Town Hall Seattle on April 14, 2014, as part of Seattle Arts and Lectures Literary Arts Series. Thanks to Ruth Dickey and Rebecca Hoogs for this recording. Please be advised, the following program contains some language of an adult nature.
Hello, thank you for coming out tonight. I am pregnant and on a lot of cold medicine, so this is going to be the greatest speech you've ever heard. It's going to get a little loopy, my friends. I thought I'd start by answering the question that I tend to get most often when I do these events, which is, what is wrong with you, really? Where did it all go so horribly dark in your life? I was born and raised in Kansas City, and my parents were... That's it. Where do you go from there, right? I grew up in a household of that was really valued stories. My dad was a film professor, and my mom taught reading, so I grew up watching just tons of movies and reading tons of books, and my parents always really encouraged the telling of stories. It was in my family, that was not a waste of time at all to spend time reading or spend time talking about stories or talking about books. And from a very young age, I was an incredibly shy kid. I was very painfully shy, and so, you know, to me, the way to deal with that was to always have my nose in a book and not have to deal with people and talking. And I started writing short stories at a really young age. My very first short story I wrote in third grade, and it was very grandly entitled "To the Outhouse," and it was from my love of Little House on the Prairie. And our family had kind of a one-room hunting cabin in southern Missouri that we would be forced to go to. And so part of my fear of that was it really did have an outhouse, and you had to go there in the middle of the night. It was really creepy. So I was like, oh, you know, I'll write a story about a little pioneer girl. She has to go to the outhouse in the middle of the night. And the story is she goes there, and she gets to the outhouse and then is immediately surrounded by wolves. And so she spends the short story thinking about how much she loves her family and, you know, churning butter or whatever she's going to do when she makes it back to safety. And, you know, she's very spunky. And at the end of the short story, she bursts forth from the outhouse, and the wolves immediately devour her alive. just tear her limb from limb, and the end. So yes, I've always been like this. People always ask, where does the darkness come from? And I really did have a very pretty conventional childhood, but I was always attracted to kind of those darker stories. And partly I blame my dad, who, like I said, was a film professor, and, you know, part of his, like, tutorial of raising a young daughter was like, we should watch Psycho. You really need to understand about Hitchcock. It's very important. You're six now. It's time to sit down and really watch these important movies. And partly just, you know, for me, the dark side always allowed for more of an imagination to wander into. You know, my cousins and I would play dress up, and we'd play, you know, pretend games, and they would always grab all the princess costumes, and I would be like, that's fine, because I will be the witch, because the witch has a backstory, you know, the princess, we know her story, she's beautiful and kind, you know, like, you know, the witch is where it's at. And, you know, so from a very young age, I always, you know, was very interested in why people did bad things and how bad things happened. And I think probably because I did come from such a, you know, safe, happy place, that my mind could kind of wander into those darker places and explore and roam around a little bit. And as I got older, I knew, you know, I wanted to write for a living, and wasn't quite sure what road I was going to take. Being a pragmatic Midwesterner, I decided to go into journalism because newspapers will be around forever. Seemed like a very safe, smart way to go. And even then, you know, I went to school. I went up to Northwestern for grad school for journalism, and thought I would be a crime reporter, because I thought that would be kind of a way to tell these stories. Again, kind of attracted to why bad things happened, and discovered very quickly on, you know, one of my early outings that they send you out as a, you know, as a teaching school. I had to cover a strike, and these are, you know, they're striking, so they would like to talk to people who are in journalism, and instead I just stood on the edge of the strike the entire time, going like, could I talk to you? Never mind, I'm sorry to bother you. And I realized very quickly that I did not have the stuff of any sort of hard-boiled journalist that I had pictured myself as, and instead, I did know where a good place for me to end up would be was a place that covered pop culture, because, again, having grown up watching movies and reading books and talking about stories, I had spent a lot of time thinking about it, so I ended up at Entertainment Weekly magazine out of school, and went to New York City, and anyone who's read Gone Girl, who reads from Nick's point of view when he's talking about those early halcyon days of journalism in the 90s before it all crashed down. You know, that was very much taken from when I had come to New York, and, you know, it was such a great job. I you know, got to, you know, I mean, you're 25 years old living in New York, and you're getting paid to watch movies and talk about movies and you know, TV and books, and I had such a great time. And I still had this kind of itch to try to write a novel, though. As much as I liked the freedom of a weekly magazine and, you know, writing something and kind of sending it off and being done with it, part of me wanted to create a world where I could really hang around in there for a while and stay. And part of me also just kind of wanted to see if I could do it. As someone who just loved books so much, I thought, you know, that it'd be so great to be able to finally write the end, to have, you know, gotten through a whole book, and I don't really need to get it published or anything. I just really wanted to kind of to see if I could do it. And I started playing around with ideas about what I wanted to write about, and I was, as someone who had grown up watching a lot of noir films and watching a lot of Westerns, I was very interested in this theme of cycles of violence and how families kind of perpetuated this violence upon each other, and how certain towns became kind of infected by this, by attitudes and by violence, but all those stories were told from a very male point of view. It's always about, you know, the father handing violence down to the son and that sort of thing, and, you know, that was all well and good, but being a woman, a violent, violent woman, I really wanted to write about the way women do that to each other, and cycles of the way, the particular form of female violence and the psychological form that it can take. And I'd come up with this kind of idea of a family that was rotating its psychological violence. down through the years in a town that kind of allowed that to prosper. And I couldn't, but I couldn't quite figure out how to tell the story. My first draft was basically a lot of people just standing in rooms and talking. And when I would get bored, I would just move them to a different room and be like, let's go to the living room and talk some more about violence. it was really painful. And I was like, let's go outside and we'll have a barbecue and we'll talk about violence some more. But I had a great epiphany, which was one night I finished work at EW and took home the book Mystic River by Dennis Lehane and read it through the night. And I thought, well, that's how I can tell this story, is I attach it to a mystery, and that's going to give me the engine and the motor and the discipline to kind of talk about all these other things that I wanted to talk about. Because for me, what I've always loved about really good mysteries is that they are about so much more. You know, the really great ones are about family and about cities and loyalty and all these kind of great larger themes. And I thought, you know, that's exactly how I would do it. So, being a Midwesterner, you know, our motto is not dream big. It's like dream moderately. And because who do you really think you are anyway? And so I didn't even really acknowledge that I was writing a book. That seemed way too grand. I would kind of sneak up on it. I was like, type a little bit and run away. And I don't remember writing the first sentence of the book or anything like that. I didn't really tell anyone I was writing the book. I would just write on evenings and weekends and was, you know, kind of gonna see where it would take me. And again, there was no pressure. I didn't have an editor or an agent or anything. I just kind of wanted to see where the story was gonna go. And part of it, you know, again, it's about a family that has kind of a violent history. And part of the mystery of Sharp Objects is figuring out the narrator is a very damaged person. She's a journalist, and it's part of the whole thing is trying to figure out exactly what has happened to her that has made her this way as she goes back home to cover these crimes that are back home. And I wrote the book literally all over the world because I was still doing my day job for Entertainment Weekly, which was to go to set visits and go to movies and cover, you know, the making of movies. So I wrote it, partly in New Zealand, like for Lord of the Rings. Like I'd go hang out with some hobbits, and I would come back and write, you know, kill some children in my book. And I wrote, I remember like spinning a full day on set of Jackass the movie somewhere in Florida, and coming back and writing these dark scenes, and you know, ultimately finished it. And you know, I think that would be my advice to anyone who does want to write that first book and doesn't quite know how to get started, is to not have that pressure of like, you know, that this is going to be my novel. To me, the sign that you're going to finish it is the sign that I got finally with Sharp Objects, which was, you know, I would put it away for months at a time, and then I would start thinking about my characters and feel and be worried about them. You know, I'd be like, I've left them in the middle of their story. Yeah, I got to go back and finish the story for them and make sure they're all dead. No happy endings for any of you. Come back like an avenging angel. The fact that they had kind of taken over my life in a way, and I would think about them the way I would think about friends, sort of. You know, like, how's so-and-so doing? Oh, you know, I better go finish the story. And, you know, people always ask me if I know how my books are going to end when I begin them. And I sometimes think I do. In Sharp Objects, I had the person who was the murderer all figured out. And I got to the end, and I didn't like that at all, and had to, you know, just rewrite. My favorite part of a book is the rewriting part. I like to get to the end of a really, really bad first draft and then get to see everything that's wrong with it and go back, and actually that's when I kind of start having fun, is when I can kind of figure out what has gone wrong and go back in and fix it. And we did, I finally did finish it, and I was happy with. It got an agent, and we sent it out, and the response we heard most was, people really don't want to read about women who are so unpleasant. I was like, well, I haven't even started yet. You think she's unpleasant? Wait till you get to Amy.
We'll be right back with more from novelist Gillian Flynn. Coming up, perhaps not surprisingly, Truman Capote's In Cold Blood has its haunting effect. And switching to bourbon with her best editor. For KUOW 94.9 Seattle and Speakers Forum, I'm John O'Brien.
KUOW. Later tonight, we're going to hear a realty agent for the town of Brady in British Columbia talk about the town being up for sale, but so far attracting no interested parties, despite spectacular views, too. That's part of As It Happens tonight at 11. Weather forecast for the Seattle area for tonight, lows in the 50s, clear but becoming mostly cloudy late tonight. Friday highs lower to mid-70s, partly sunny, a chance of afternoon showers. Friday night, lows 50s to lower 60s, partly cloudy, and Saturday highs near 80 and sunny. Mostly sunny on Saturday. Support for KUOW comes from the Northwest Traverse Multisport Series, a statewide series of multisport relays for solo and teams to include running, paddling, and mountain and road biking. Hosted in North Bend on September 6th, with the grand finale on September 20th in Bellingham. Registration at northwesttraverse.com. And support for KUOW comes from Blue Homes, architect-designed modern homes built by Blue craftsmen from start to finish, offering tours of the energy-efficient Glide House located on Vashon Island. That'll be on August 23rd and 24th from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. More at bluhomes.com/events.
Welcome back to Speakers Forum on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Gillian Flynn writes thriller novels with a dark edge. The Guardian newspaper said of her, "She is a virtuoso of the not quite right detail, the skin-crawling sense that something is very wrong, that it is under your nose, yet you can't make out what it is." Now, more from Gillian Flynn on how she found her way to writing best-selling psychological thrillers.
I kept my day job and started writing Dark Places, and Dark Places kind of came from, again, going back to my childhood fascination of all things dark. When I was about 12, I'd gotten a hold of a copy of In Cold Blood. And I mean, you know, I was almost a woman. It was time. And, you know, I grew up right on the border of Kansas, and so to me, it felt, you know, the fact that it was kind of a real thing. I was really fascinated with that book, and Dark Places has as its central image a farmhouse in the middle of Kansas. Farm country, and a family that's dead inside and has been murdered, and what has happened. And from there, it goes in a very different direction. But that was kind of the start of it, was my fascination with that story and how it had always kind of haunted me. And so the story ended up being that, and you know this from the very outset of the novels, that this family has been killed, and the youngest daughter has escaped and has blamed her older brother for all the murders of her sisters and her mom. And now it's years later, and she's starting to doubt. She was so young at the time. She's starting to doubt what the truth of what has happened. And, you know, I was trying to write from, the character's name is Libby, and I was trying to write from her point of view. And I was starting out, you know, and it was first person, and I thought, you know, gosh, you know, I don't want to be like dark female narrator girl, because I saw, well, that worked out for me, not avoiding that. So I was like, I'm just not going to do it. I'm going to write a different kind of character. I'm going to write, you know, I'm going to write the opposite of my previous book. And so Libby's going to be very, you know, I wrote the first draft where she was very spunky and very can-do, and Her best friend was her childhood psychologist, and she had conquered all her demons, and she might as well have taught jazzercise. She was so like, like, we can solve this mystery. And let's go, gang. And my lovely husband, who is my first and best reader, I gave him the first draft, and you know, I knew it was going to be bad when he started moving toward our wine cabinet. And he's kind of like carefully making his way over there. He's like, so, you know, this part's working, and, you know, this I like all this. And, you know, then he, of course, he's like, so how do you feel about Libby? And he's like, glug, 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 glug. And, you know, but it's a question I needed to hear, because immediately I was like, ah, you know, I can't stand her. Oh, she's such a goody-two-shoes, and, you know, can you believe she's so perfect? And you know, he said, yeah, he's like, you can tell you don't like her. You can tell you don't believe in her. You can tell you don't enjoy writing her. Every time you get back to her parts, you know, you can feel it not working. And so we switched to bourbon. And I just deleted. I deleted all of Libby's scenes. I didn't want to try to make any of it work. I just knew I had to start over completely with a character that would make sense, because it didn't make sense that this woman who had suffered through all this, you know, horror, that she would actually be that well balanced at this point. That time, an opening line did come to me, which was, I have a meanness inside me, real as an organ. And I thought, I got Libby. I have Libby figured out now. And so that was kind of my big lesson from writing Dark Places, which was kind of probably one of the trickiest on my books as far as just figuring out who these characters were, which was, you kind of have to let the characters be who they are. You know, at least for me, I can't force, you know, I can't force certain things that the story doesn't want to do. And I do believe in kind of listening to where the story wants to take you. I mean, people always ask me if I outline, and you know, I really don't do too much outlining, because I want that flexibility, and I want that magic of the story taking over itself and becoming its own special thing. And that to me is the fun of writing, when you actually stop trying to force yourself into the book and let the book speak for itself. And then I was going to start my third book, and I still had my day job, and then I got laid off from my day job. And I was like, well, I guess I'm a full-time novelist now. Which raised the stakes a little bit, and I started writing Gone Girl, and I knew from the beginning, I kind of transferred a lot of my angst about not having a job onto Nick. And so Nick kind of became all the sort of angst that you hear Nick say about having lost his job and not being sure who he is without this job, was very much how I felt. I had only written for a living. I had, you know, I'd gotten out of school, and I had gotten the job at Entertainment Weekly, and I'd stayed there, and the only other jobs I ever had was, I used to dress up as a yogurt cone in a mall and give out yogurt samples, but I didn't know if I could go back to that. And then I also did a very exciting stint as a honey-baked ham girl. Would display hams for people and let them see the spiral and make sure it was cut well, and then put it back and then get them another ham. So those were kind of my two claims to fame of possible other jobs that I could do. And, you know, I really was sort of like, you know, if this book is awful, you know, and I can't write for a living, you know, where do I go? So I channeled a lot of that sort of angst into Nick as I was figuring out who Nick was. And for those of you who don't know the basics of Gone Girl, it's about Nick and Amy Dunn. And Nick Dunn has lost his, they both have lost their jobs as journalists in New York City. and they've returned to Nick's hometown in Missouri. And Nick comes home on his 5-year anniversary and reports his wife Amy has disappeared. And so you spend a lot of time in Nick's mind, and you're not supposed to really know for sure what has happened to Amy, what Nick's involvement is with Amy. And it kind of goes from there. And I knew from the very beginning a couple things about Gone Girl. I didn't know really what had happened, but I knew that I did want an unreliable narrator. To me, an unreliable narrator is one of the most... I love as a reader being in that position where you get about 40 or 50 pages in, and the person that you've entrusted to a story, you realize maybe you shouldn't trust. I just think that's such a great sort of uneasy ground to be on. And so I knew that Nick would be an unreliable narrator. The whole point was that I knew you shouldn't be for sure exactly what had happened behind closed doors, and that here were these people who were, you know, very photogenic and looked great on paper, but that you didn't really know what happened behind closed doors. And I also had been, as a person who's fascinated with true crime and how true crime gets reported and how true crime gets packaged, and sort of has turned into a sort of commodity almost in our culture, this sort of like consuming of other people's tragedy, which I'm certainly guilty of. That idea of, what happens to a husband when he's in that position? When, you know, our first instinct at this point is to be trained that we automatically always assume that the husband did it. And how in that sort of circumstances do you possibly act like a normal human being? You know, you know, there's a line in the book, like, you'd almost have to be a psychopath to be able to act normally in that sort of circumstances where all the eyes are on you. And no matter how you grieve or how you react to this situation, people are gonna, you know, if you're too heavy with emotion, people say, oh, he's putting on an act. If you're not showing enough emotion, oh, he doesn't really care. And so I thought that would be a fun thing to kind of play with all the way through. And I spent a lot of time, Gone Girl was certainly the first book that I felt the plot was going to drive a lot of it, the plot kind of came first, that I knew, you know, that this is going to be what happens. This guy comes home, he reports his wife missing. There's going to have to be some sort of twist at some point. And so I kind of ask myself a lot of questions, like, who are these two people? Who are people who would get in this situation? What are they like? And I kind of had to reverse engineer who these people were according to the predicament they... I'm trying to speak very carefully for those who have not read it, so I'm trying to choose my words carefully. And so I spent a lot of time, you know, I do a lot of really old-fashioned writing exercises, kind of stuff from... high school and college writing classes. You know, I kind of have a little questionnaire for all my characters, you know, that's down to everything from, like, do they eat breakfast? You know, if not, you know, why not? If they do, what do they eat? Oh, you know, what's... I knew what was on each of their iPod playlists. So, you know, I made playlists for each of them. I knew it was on their Netflix queues. I knew, you know, Do they remember birthdays? Do they not remember birthdays? Do they make lists? Do they not make lists? And just really gave myself a lot of time trying to figure out who these people were. And Nick came to me much more quickly than Amy did, because he was kind of the known quantity from the beginning. And I did give him a lot of my own personal biography. You know, kid from Missouri, you know, goes to New York, journalism, possibly oversteeped in pop culture, debatable, and so I figured him out, but Amy took on a lot of different... she had a lot of different personalities as I was trying to figure out. Her family had originally, in the book, she's the kind of inspiration for a children's book series called Amazing Amy, in which it's supposed to teach kids how to be perfect, basically, that her parents have written, called Amazing Amy, that's kind of based on her. But originally they had started out, and the first version, her family had run a dating website, like a sort of eHarmony kind of matchmaking for marriage. That was almost a little too easy. It was too on the nose. And so, you know, it took different forms, and I finally figured out that Amy, yeah, had been this product of this kind of adoration and idolization that she hadn't necessarily earned. And, you know, I thought that was kind of the key to her. And I will not give anything away, but once I kind of figured out who she was, I knew I wanted to hear from her earlier in the book. And so I had the idea of the diary entries, and then the twist. And once I had decided on the twist, which we will say no more of, you know, that was my biggest. I fought against that so hard. I had not set out to do that. And once I realized that, I got really scared because I thought, you know, either this is really going to work and people are going to like it, or it's not going to work at all and it's going to be just embarrassing and awful. And so I did a lot of, you know, once I had decided on that, then, you know, that's when I talk about rewriting. I went back over and over again and tried to nail down everything. I tried to make sure that Nick and Amy felt as real as possible, because I knew as far out as the story can kind of get, that you had to really believe in these two people as real human beings. And so, you know, I wanted all their details kind of correct. And, you know, I wanted all the plot points kind of nailed down. And so, you know, As I was writing, I would write everything down to fact check. You know, there's all sorts of different chronologies. There's all sorts of different lies that have their own chronologies. There's 8 million different timelines. And I work in our, this is going to sound weird, I work in our basement. my office is in the basement of our house. And you kind of go out of the house and go back under. It's this old Chicago Victorian that I kind of, you walk through this unfinished basement that really, really sets the mood for horror. it's like cement floors, and there's like a root cellar off to one side where I'm sure someone's buried. And, you know, there's like old metal tools hanging on the walls from the 1800s or something, I don't know. And so I run through there, and then I hit the little area where I write, and I would, my organizational skills go like this. I go, oh, I should remember to make sure that makes sense. And so I write a couple key words on a sticky note, and then I just stick it on the wall. And so by the end of the, you know, about 2 years I was writing this book. And so by the end of it, the walls were just covered with like fluttering pieces of paper that with words that meant nothing to anyone but me. It'd be like, is mom dead yet? Where did she leave the car? And like, and it was awesome because that's also where our guest room is to our house. So people would come to stay with us and be like, and make yourself comfortable. if you dare. And so that was kind of basically how it all got written, is sort of, you know, little pieces at a time and finally nailing it all down. And, you know, people always ask me if I knew the book was going to be as well received as it was. And, you know, absolutely not. I mean, it was, I knew that I'd written a book that I like, but obviously, I have very weird tastes, so I had no idea if anyone else would want to read this book. And it's not a traditional mystery in that, you know, the mystery is kind of revealed partway through, and then you head into a different direction. And you know, my editor is kind of like, "Well, good luck with this." we'll keep our fingers crossed for you. You know, our hope was it would, you know, build a little bit on the previous two. And so it was really cool to see it become a book that people kind of wanted to talk about and people wanted to pass on to their friends and discuss. And I do think a lot of that's because, as like I said, as wild as the story gets, that people recognize something of the different relationships that are at the heart of it, that kind of give and take of a long-term relationship. And, you know, people like to to dissect, you know, different parts of the book and different ways characters treat each other, and, you know, Team Nick or Team Amy, and people like to tell me how much they hate the ending, which we can discuss later. But to me, the great thing about writing a book is, you know, you're by yourself for, you know, a long period of time, and you know, you're just in your head. And so I love it when people, even when people say they hate the ending or say, you know, have different reactions to it, I like to hear about it, because to me that's all a book is supposed to do, is to make you want to think about it, to make you imagine the characters outside of the book, to wonder what they're going to do next, and to kind of want to talk about it. And so to me, it's always thrilling, and it's continually surprising when people say that, you know, that they've read the book and they mention different parts to me. It's like, oh, right, it's out there in the world. It's its own sort of thing, which is very fun for me. And the film version of it is going to come out in October, which I'm really excited about, and I got to write the screenplay for that, and I think I will probably discuss that with my friend Maria shortly. But that process was itself its own kind of new bit of fun, of trying to dissemble a book that you've spent a lot of time putting together and re-put it, you know, reassemble it as a movie. You know, my first, the usual screenplay is probably about 110 pages or so. And my first draft was like 380 pages or something. I was like, could it be a mini series? Is that? it was really fun to get to see, you know, I would get to go on set and wander around these places that had been in my brain for years. And, you know, the exteriors were all filmed down in Cape Girardeau, Missouri, right on the Mississippi River. Looked exactly like I describe in the book. And so, you know, I spent one night after everyone had kind of gone to bed, and I walked from the police station where Nick had been interrogated over to, you know, the vigil that he has for Amy, and down to the bar that he has with Gil. And I thought, well, this, what an incredibly strange and surreal experience this is. It's not every time that someone takes something that is in your brain and turns it 3D.
Thanks for tuning into Speakers Forum. Coming up, Seattle novelist Maria Semple joins Gillian Flynn on stage at Town Hall for questions and a reading of the infamous Cool Girl passage. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.
We're 16 minutes and change away from 10 o'clock, KUOW 94.9. Stories of getting stuck and breaking free. The walls are closing in, you've got no way out, and then suddenly you escape. Stories about traps, getaways, perpetual cycles, and staggering breakthroughs. It's all about escape on Radiolab tomorrow evening at 7. Support for KUOW comes from Whitefish, Montana, a mountain town nestled at the edge of Glacier National Park, with hiking, biking, and paddling through the golden colors of autumn. Information at explorewhitefish.com. Forecast for the Seattle area for tonight, lows in the 50s. Clear at first, becoming mostly cloudy late tonight. Friday, highs lower to mid-70s. Partly sunny, a chance of afternoon showers. Vocalist, bassist, and songwriter Kate Davis talks about and presents examples of her work, including her original songs Movie and Every Good Girl is a Unicorn. That song travels beginning in just a few minutes at 10 o'clock.
Welcome back to the last segment of tonight's Speakers Forum on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Next up, more on a best-selling writer's craft with Gillian Flynn. Now joined by Seattle writer Maria Semple.
Hi, I'll first say, Gillian, that you're so talented and smart and beautiful and successful that forgive me for being...
This is starting out great.
Yeah, exactly. Forgive me for being secretly delighted that you're fat. I got that on you. So I don't even know if you write mysteries or thrillers. How would you describe the genre?
You know, I kind of describe mine as psychological thrillers. I feel like mystery kind of implies a certain coziness that my books definitely don't have. And I think straight thriller, I always picture much more like a serial killer type of story, whereas to me, the books that I write and a lot of the books that I like to read are very much more mind games. They're games that people are playing with each other in their head more than a physical sort of danger.
I see, because it seems, reading your books, that they're so, the plots are so perfect and they're so intricately plotted. It really, I was very interested to hear that that you're not going plot first, that's not the first thing and then everything gets filled in later. I would just assume that that's how these books are written.
Yeah. No, I mean, I really do, you know, I'll be 20, 30 pages from the end going like, huh, I wonder how this is going to end.
Wow.
And then my job is once I figure that out and have that really, like I said, the really crummy first draft, then I can go back and actually that's when I start having fun and I put in the, you know, I put in all the clues and I put in, you know, the actual plot parts.
Because that's how I write kind of half. I have the document open and I have the outline going, and it's almost 50-50 to me.
Okay.
when I write. Is that what it sounds like? You put a lot of work into, I mean, just keeping track of the stuff, because you need to be in a bit of a flow state, like writing and having a good time, but then suddenly you'll write something and go, wait, this has a lot of implications if I'm going to keep it, and you need to kind of keep track of that stuff. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like that's what you're doing with the sticky notes and things.
Yeah, exactly. I'll just, you know, remember this, or I'll put a date on, or particularly with Gone Girl, which does, like I said, not only do Nick and Amy have their own chronologies, but the different lies that they're telling have, there's certain chronologies that you have to keep track of. And so, you know, I had timelines for everything.
And that's really fun. I mean, I love doing that myself. And do you really love that as much as writing, just the intricacy of the plotting?
The tending to the different plot points. It doesn't come easily to me. I am not a naturally organized person. So I wouldn't say that, like, that feels natural to me, but like once I got into it and once I got involved with it, you know, I started writing everything down. I mean, to the point where there's like a joke where Nick and Amy and Nick and Go and the bar giveaways old dusty Zimas
had
found, and I was like, were Zimas even invented in 1998 or whatever it was? I was like, I've got to check this out, you know.
Well, it's a good kind of distraction, isn't it? An internet distraction.
Yeah.
I have to go look that up. I know I wasn't supposed to check the internet for 1 hour, but this can't wait.
You can pretend like you're working, exactly.
and doing your research. So I bet like a lot of people, my first book of yours was Gone Girl. Then I went and read Dark Places, and I just read Sharp Objects. So I kind of went backwards. And it seems to me, I'm just going to throw this at you. It seems to me like you're getting kind of less dark and almost kind of more confident as you write. I feel like Sharp Objects is so kind of dense and hard. It's so, there's kind of an ugliness to the detail and the attitudes, and it feels like you're getting more kind of confident and loosening up as a writer in terms of that like dark, edgy stuff. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm. You know, I read Sharp Objects, and you know, first of all, it's much more traditional.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it flows. It's very chronological. It's much more of a whodunit.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think the voice is really interesting. It is darker. It's almost kind of gothic.
Right.
And I think,
and her body, and it's just you really are pushing it in that book, I think. Yeah.
And I think part of that was, you know, because at the time I was working full time at Entertainment Weekly, where I was writing really kind of funny, conversational, lighter sort of thing. So I would go home at night and in order to possibly write after you've been writing for 8 hours.
Wow.
And then write some more. I was like, you know, I was like, just darker, darker.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Just so it felt different, I guess.
That's right. And it feels like I feel an easing up of that in your subsequent books. It And even though Gone Girl obviously is very dark, I mean, I loved the lightness of the Amy stuff in the beginning. I just thought that was, it was just pure, joyous, just happy, knowing energy, you know? Mm-hmm. And that was, I think, a note for you to hit, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I think the more confident you become as a writer, I realized that there was room for humor there. There was room for different voices. You know, and it didn't have to be all just one tone all the way through. You could balance different emotions and tones.
Do you have a favorite book? I mean, like if your books are, just to be crude, your children, or do you have like I feel like you say, like, Gone Girl is really out in the world. And I find as a writer that my experience and my relationship with my book is very different from other people's relationships with it. So I'm wondering, like with your three books, if I say Sharp Objects, what is that book to you, if you think of the book?
You know, I think Sharp Objects is kind of like the precocious, brassy child, you know? Yeah. It was sort of me going out in the world and kind of really trying to have a big voice. And, you know, I'm very fond of it, but it's definitely sort of that, like, it's the first novel of, like, I want to have this big voice out in the world.
I see. And what about Dark Places?
You know, I really like Dark Places. I Libby is one of my favorite characters.
Yeah, I love Dark Places. I mean, you don't want to pick favorites, but I mean, I love Dark Places. Yeah.
It was one of the, you know, it was the first time I played with, you know, writing from different points of view and different chronologies. And you know, Libby is just a character that she's one of those people I think of as, you know, as if she's still out in the world. You know, I'll think of her once in a while, you know, I wonder what Libby's up to. Like, no good, probably, but...
Yeah. And Gone Girl.
And then, Gone Girl was hard. You know, it was the hardest one to write? The difficult child, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I really... you know, in addition to the panic of feeling like I now had to write a book because I didn't have, you know, a job to fall back on, there was a lot of that pressure on that. And it was, you know, and it was more experimental than the other ones. And like, you know, like I said, that idea of, you know, putting in a twist, putting in, you know, different styles, you know, choosing to do the diary, that sort of thing. And not really knowing if I was going to pull it off, you know, so that was the one I felt probably the most nervous about constantly.
I'm going to ask you to read a passage from Gone Girl. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay. So I want you to read my favorite passage, which I'm sure people will know what it is. The cool girl passage. Cause I think that this is really why the book broke out, or let's talk about it. But this, I've marked off where I'd like you to read. Okay.
All right. This has a few dirty words in it. So if anyone does not like profanity, you should probably not be here at all and not read my books, but just to warn you. And this actually, well, I'll read this and then I'll tell you the inspiration for it.
Should we read into it? Should we explain it a little bit?
Not, yeah, you're just, probably right. This is Amy talking. It's pretty self-explanatory.
Yeah, it is.
But this
it's is Amy,
from,
yeah.
This is from Amy's point of view when she's thinking about the first time that she met Nick. That night at the Brooklyn party, I was playing the girl who was in style, the girl a man like Nick wants, the cool girl. Men always say that as the defining compliment, don't they? She's a cool girl. Being the cool girl means I'm a hot, brilliant, funny woman who adores football, poker, dirty jokes, and burping, who plays video games, drinks cheap beer, loves threesomes and sex, and jams hot dogs and hamburgers into her mouth like she's hosting the world's biggest culinary gangbang while somehow maintaining a size 2, because cool girls are above all hot. Hot and understanding. Cool girls never get angry. They only smile in a chagrined, loving manner and let their men do whatever they want. Go ahead, on me. I don't mind. I'm the cool girl. Men actually think this girl exists. Maybe they're fooled because so many women are willing to pretend to be this girl. For a long time, cool girl offended me. I used to see men, friends, coworkers, strangers, giddy over these awful pretender women, and I'd want to sit these men down and calmly say, you are not dating a woman. You are dating a woman who has watched too many movies written by socially awkward men who'd like to believe that this kind of woman exists and might kiss them. I want to grab the poor guy by his lapels or messenger bag and say, the bitch doesn't really love chili dogs that much. No one loves chili dogs that much. And the cool girls are even more pathetic. They're not even pretending to be a woman they want to be. They're pretending to be a woman a man wants them to be. Oh, and if you're not a cool girl, I beg you to not believe that your man doesn't want the cool girl. And maybe a slightly different version. Maybe he's a vegetarian, so cool girl loves seitan and is great with dogs. Or maybe he's a hipster artist, so cool girl's a tattooed, bespectacled nerd who loves comics. There are variations to the window dressing, but believe me, he wants cool girl, who's basically the girl who likes every thing he likes and doesn't ever complain. How do you know you're not cool girl? Because he says things like, I like strong women. If he says that to you, he will at some point fuck someone else. Because I like strong women is code for I hate strong women. I waited patiently, years, for the pendulum to swing the other way, for men to start reading Jane Austen, learn how to knit, pretend to love cosmos, organize scrapbook parties, and make out with each other while we leer. And then we'd say, yeah, he's a cool guy. But it never happened. Instead, women across the nation colluded in our degradation. Pretty soon, cool girl became the standard girl. Men believed she existed. She wasn't just a dream girl, one in a million. Every girl was supposed to be this girl. And if you weren't, then there was something wrong with you.
Yeah. I love that passage, and I feel like as much as I loved the book, this is after the twist, let's just say.
Yeah.
This comes, okay. So even after the book, I mean, I love that early Amy stuff. It really, like I say, it had so much energy to it. It was so bright and so delightful, and then there's the twist. And then there's this cool girl passage, and as soon as I read that, I felt like the book just went to a new place, mm-hmm. You know, went to this higher place. It became kind of relevant and challenging. Now, men, I don't think like this passage very much. I've talked to some men who really don't like this passage, but I did. When you wrote that, just writer to writer, did you think like, was there some crazy energy? Were you like, holy? This is like electric, or is that was just something you slogged through to try to get it right?
No, you know, it's funny. I wrote it actually as one of these writing exercises when I was kind of stuck and trying to figure out who Amy was. And so I would do all these writing exercises, and my whole rule with a writing exercise is it doesn't go in the book. Because that way it takes the pressure off of you. And so, you know, when I would get stuck, I would write something, you know, I would say, like, let's just take a break. I'm going to write, you know, a scene from Amy's high school roommate, her point of view, and, you know, just a moment in time. And just to try to see these characters from kind of different points of view where I got to know them a little bit better. And the cool girl was, I wanted to figure out what Amy was a journalist, and I wanted to figure out what kind of things that she would write. Mm-hmm. And at the time, again, this is one of the different many iterations of Amy. For a while, I thought, you know, maybe she did kind of a feminist columnist, or, you know, mm-hmm. a he said, she said kind of, a, you know, what it's like to be a woman kind of column. And so I wrote that from her point of view. And then I liked it so much I couldn't get rid of it. I was like, I will find a place for in the book for this, because I loved writing that.
Are there other
speech.
Passages that were writing exercises that you made that you just
not
loved
a,
so much?
Not
that
a single
was
other one. That was the only
oh,
one.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, the final question. After writing Gone Girl, do you think you could pull off the perfect crime?
Well, it would hardly be the perfect crime if I admitted that I could pull
That's
off the
right.
perfect crime, correct? I have to pretend like I couldn't ever do that.
Yeah.
You know, I always think that I could absolutely pull off the perfect crime. I just couldn't follow through with it, because the second a cop showed up at my door, I'd be like, I did it! Ah! I would not be the cool under pressure, but I could definitely frame someone. And if they went to jail and...
Stay away from Gillian Flynn, everybody. But not at the signing table. She'll be right there.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.